Welcome to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life.
Tell us, oh muse, about a man whose mind and career has careened far and wide and upside down, whose computers are seared with crimes against grammar, whose typographical aggressions are legion, whose words flow into the very mouth of time, and more than a few bottles. A man who actually owns a typewriter, and perhaps even a soul.
And now, your host, John King.
Welcome, my friends, to episode 604 of the World's Greatest Writing Podcast. On today's show, my friend Rachel Tillman and I discuss the science fiction classic Neuromancer by William Gibson. I suppose this might be the conclusion of a trilogy of episodes in which Rachel and I discuss William Gibson's work. Back on 565, we discussed his novel Pattern Recognition, and in episode 576, we discussed his essay collection Distrust That Particular Flavor. I do find it shocking that it's only in my 50s that I'm dipping my toe into the work of William Gibson, since it seems like my nefarious literary friends and drug-adjacent people probably should have recommended his work to me by now. The Venn diagram of people that William Gibson and I admire seems to be pretty dense. You know, if we're going to do more episodes on William Gibson, which I am certainly not opposed to, maybe I should strive to get the man on the show himself. So how's your writing been going? Mine has been going in stops and starts. I've been working on an essay about fountain pens that don't work, that I've been writing with fountain pens that do work. And I think the problem was I was writing with fountain pens that did work. So after reaching an not even a meaningful aporia, which is one of those moments at the end of Plato's Dialogues where basically the conversation is brought to a halt without a conclusion because time is a thing. So I talked to my friend Jared Sylvia about this project, and he helped me continue to think about this, but also, yeah, in order to properly write this essay, I need to write it with the pens that don't work. So, and in the back of my mind, there is some slight concern that this all really amounts to a lot of trickery to trick my mind into writing when I'm otherwise overworked and find my mind frazzled. Maybe you can relate. So I do have two public events on my schedule, including this Tuesday on December 5th, I and Amy Watkins will be the opening act for the Loose Lips reading series. This is going to be a miniature reading called In Buzo Veritas, in which I test out before audiences poems that I hope will end up in a completed poetry manuscript called In Buzo Veritas. Hopefully a video of that will be forthcoming soon. And then in a week, on December 9th from noon to 3 p.m., Nick Gergidiou and I will be hosting a type-in at the Kerouac Project of Orlando. You can check out this week's show notes for details about that. All right, let's get to the discussion of the 1984 classic, Neuromancer.
And now, the interview of the day.
I am joined once again by my friend Rachel, and we are here for round three of William Gibson.
Good afternoon, John. We are here to discuss Neuromancer, which honestly is one of my favorite novels. I'm very excited to have an excuse to talk about it at length for, what, hour and a half? Why not? I first read it in middle school, and I've read it many times since. It's aged well, and thank you so much for joining us in our other super secret, top secret location.
Yeah, I don't know if it has aged that well. I mean, why did it rip off The Matrix?
It's funny. I mean, like, it has aged well, but it's also very much confined to the fact that it was written in the 80s.
1984 is the publication year.
Yeah.
And so the podcast, or me, I've really backed into William Gibson's writing. We talked first about his nonfiction collection, which
yes,
I found charming. And, you know, he talks a lot about his writing there, which is funny because I hadn't read his writing. It's a little bit like, I don't know, reading a study of someone's art and then you haven't seen the art and then you go and look at the art. It's not the ideal order to do it in.
I don't know. I actually think that could be quite beneficial because, yes, you've never seen the art. You've never read the stories. You've never read the novels or the poems. But you go in there with a sense of intention, of purpose, the creative inspiration. And you can work backwards from there. I've done that. I've read series out of order. I've read about the writer before I ever touched the work. And I found that it actually made the reading experience more pleasurable. And it honestly cleared up maybe the more vague aspects of their plot, if that makes any sense. And I believe the same could be true with William Gibson. I think in a way you have to read about him, or it helps to read about him before you read him. Everyone may not agree with me, but that's just how I've gone into it.
Well, to go back to the Matrix analogy, right? I think it was 99 when The Matrix came out.
Yeah, it was. It was 99.
The first time when I saw it in the theater, you know, the first act and Neo is learning about The Matrix, it's a little mind-blowing and it requires some mental adjustment because of just how smart it was. But it also had visual metaphors to help deliver what was a fairly complicated setup and message. And William Gibson only had words in 1984 to cover much of the same ground.
Hmm.
And so, yeah, The Matrix is derived not completely from cyberpunk and what William Gibson is doing in Neuromancer, but a lot of what we see happening in The Matrix actually, like, you know, the forefather would be William Gibson.
Well, yeah, there's a reason why so many science fiction writers reference him. Especially those in my demographic, you know, millennial science fiction writers, a lot of them will say, hey, William Gibson's Neuromancer. And I mean, I feel like you couldn't have The Matrix if you didn't have Neuromancer. I mean, essentially, the protagonist, I mean, I don't want to know if I can call him a hero, but Case, the protagonist of Neuromancer, is pretty much, you know, Case walked so Neo could run. If that's as the saying go, Case walked in the prison of his flesh, so Neo could run in those enormous boots, very 90s, very late 90s.
And before
Keanu
Reeves as Neo ran in those boots, he walked as Johnny Mnemonic.
Yes, he walked. He did walk
in
as
a cyberpunk story that, right, we talked a little bit about the movie of Johnny Mnemonic, and it's goofy, and we could say it hasn't aged well, but I would say the goofiness of it actually is a deep part of its charm.
Yeah.
Trying to imagine like what cyberspace is like before The Matrix could do like fairly huge things to depict that. And you say that Henry Case, who is the main character of Neuromancer, isn't a hero. And I guess that really depends on whether we think Molly Millions is a decent person or not. Because here's why. Maybe he's an anti-hero.
Oh, very much so.
In which
very
case,
much so.
Right, my definition, and I think this is my own coinage. I didn't come up with the term anti-hero, but my definition of an anti-hero is the least bad person in a completely rotten world.
I feel that Molly Millions, she's a great character. Whether she's good or not, I mean, that could be debated for a while. But for me, I always felt like she was a product of her world and her upbringing. And she was doing the best she could with a very bad, difficult hand, and has risen to be independent, to become physically stronger. I mean, physically, she's incredible. I mean, she's almost beyond human, to live a life on her terms. And in a way, that's Case. Case is also the same could be said about him. He is a product of his world, his environment, his upbringing, and he's doing the best he can. He made mistakes. He's learned from them, but now he needs to do what he needs to do to get his foothold back into the world. And you're not always going to do good things, but I don't think that means that they're inherently bad people.
They're the least worst people.
They're the least worst people. Yes, the least worst people. It's like you're
Molly knows right from wrong. And when she's able, she chooses right. But that doesn't mean she's always able.
Oh, of course.
And Henry Case is worse because if he could just be a degenerative drug addict for the rest of his life, that's something he might choose. In fact, he tries to choose it.
Oh, he tries.
In this story.
He tries. He almost kills himself a bunch of times. But yeah, you feel if he had not made the poor decisions that kind of threw him into the plot of Neuromancer, he would be popping pills and doing goodness knows what till the day he died, which I guess given how much he does it would be very soon, sooner rather than later.
So can you give us a plot summary?
Oh, goodness. It's three stories wearing a trench coat and they all come together beautifully. I would say Case is I guess what we would call a hacker in the broadest sense of the world. A cowboy. He's a console cowboy. I love that. No one says that anymore, but that's what he is. Who is absolutely brilliant at his profession and is paid apparently very well for it. However, when he makes the mistake of stealing from an employer, they poison him slowly. They basically strip him of his ability to do what he does. They take his gift from him. He experiences massive brain damage, which has no impact on his intelligence or his ability to walk or talk, but he cannot do his job. Because in this world, you literally work inside your head. So our plot begins...
People in Case's line of work do.
Exactly.
Not everyone does.
And Case's line of work, he receives a job offer that would reverse the damage, allow him to do what he does, but he has to do various things before that happens, and he's taken to a clinic, and he's taken care of, he's even taking shopping. However, at the same time, he is poisoned, and he is told if he makes the same mistake, the poison sacs will dissolve, and not only will he not be able to do what he does, he will die.
I'm hoping this will be my last film reference on this episode, but...
Probably not, but go ahead.
There, William Gibson is ripping off Escape from New York.
I've actually never seen Escape from New York. I've seen the posters.
The idea of the ticking clock and the injected poisons that will kill you unless they are deactivated before the end, the clock reaches its terminus is a nifty little bit from Escape from New York.
If I could ruffle some feathers, the world that Case inhabits, one, I think actually the humorous thing, it actually takes place in this year, I would say. It's set in, I mean, I guess it's pretty much about close to mid 21st century, which is almost where we're at now. You know, corporations really are incredibly powerful. I would say it's a perverse libertarian dream. Like I said, that may not hit everyone well, but this is not a world where the governments have the power like they do now, if you can call it whatever they have. But corporations truly are incredibly influential. They wield power in every respect of the word. They influence not just the economies, but they own people. I mean, if you read more of Gibson's work, they really do own their people, and they can give you a wonderful life if you get in line. And this isn't much of a spoiler because it's mentioned many times, but I do think this is important. In this world, you have the sprawl. Listener, imagine a city that extends from Manhattan, or really Boston, all the way down to Atlanta. A single city with public transportation, one big, expansive, all-encompassing city from north to south. I imagine that it would look absolutely jaw-dropping, but I cannot imagine it's very good for the ecosystem, which by then, of course, is already fried. But this is the world that we're in, and that's just a portion of the world. They don't really get into the West Coast. That's actually William Gibson's other work, where I believe the Golden Gate Bridge is actually also a massive habitation for the dispossessed, which, I mean, we can get into that. That's a whole other can of worms right there. But that also very much influences who and what case is, if you can imagine a world in a city that big.
So Case, mm-hmm. and he lives in Japan in a place called Chiba City, and I'm hoping that's named after Sonny Chiba, the Kung Fu star. He's hired to do a job by someone named Armitage, and Armitage turns out has a different identity and something like a previous life.
A questionable past, to put it mildly.
And also is kind of working as an agent on behalf of someone else.
Yeah. It's kind of a nesting doll, a rushing nesting doll of motivations and plans and plots. Oh, and the space Rastafarians. They are space Rastafarians. We won't really get into that too much, but if you read it, they are there. So yeah, that's pretty much what's happening when we meet poor Case.
And Case is kind of a sorry, sad case. His ex-girlfriend has just ripped him off.
He
owes people money. So, yeah, you said that Neuromancer has aged really well, and I think there are a couple of reasons for that, despite the fact that his work has been so influential.
Mm-hmm.
So that sometimes when we look at classic work that's been really influential, we feel like we can blame that old work for being a hack, for copying all these things which were the actual copies. So if this whole point was to be really excited and moved by the idea of cyberspace and crimes that might be committed in cyberspace, we would have forgotten about this book. It wouldn't have the cultural weight that it does.
Hmm.
But William Gibson has some razzle dazzle. So this is a heist movie, actually. This is a heist story.
It is. It is a heist story at its core. It is very much a heist story.
And, you know, it's a heist kind of involving military and industrial espionage. So, like, there's a little bit of a spy story, or a lot of a spy story.
Yeah.
Thrown in there. Plus, there's this real gritty, ugly, nasty sense of the underworld, which I remember in his nonfiction book talking about how one of his most influential writers as a science fiction writer was William S. Burroughs, who's not central to the science fiction canon. But one of the things that happens in Naked Lunch, anyway, is there's a lot of slang. There's a lot of street slang. And I want to say maybe a copy of Junkie, Burroughs' first novel. When it was published, I want to say it had a like little dictionary of the slang in the back. I think one of the editions did. But like Burroughs, Gibson doesn't hold your hand and go, behold the sprawl. Like it's in medias res.
Yeah.
So that you're supposed to feel overwhelmed.
Yeah, and that's
for
why,
a while. Although maybe kind of overwhelmed throughout the whole book. And when you kind of figure out some things, like, okay, and he gives you new things to be overwhelmed by, which is why actually reading one of his later books was actually a really good practice, because in that other book, he was gentler.
Oh, yeah, no, his Millennium Trilogy is gentler than his Sprawl Trilogy and works like Udoru and some of his short stories. One thing that I was thinking about, I did a reread a few weeks ago, and again, this came out, 1984? I was barely walking at that point, just to age myself. I feel that he was expressing what we thought the internet and cyberspace was going to be versus what it is now. And I think at that point, you know, cyberspace, the internet, was going to be seen as a tool to share, swap, and hide, conceal incredible information, that this would reshape the world. And yes, of course it has, but in a different way than William Gibson expected. This was, the internet would be used for military and economic and strategic purposes. And, you know, we would have people, this whole other class of people who manipulated it beyond the constraints of their physical bodies. And they would kind of have their own celebrity status, and they would be paid vast sums of money to do this and that and spy. And it was going to be a tool to send us into the 21st, 22nd century. And it felt so serious and heavy and laden with purpose. And then what I think about what the internet is now, as weird as this is, I do think the internet now is softer than the internet of William Gibson's intentions. Now, there's terrible things floating around on the internet right now, but considering what he thought it was going to be in 1984 and what it is now, I kind of cross my fingers and say, well, thank goodness that's not what we're dealing with. The world would be a much more volatile place, and it's already pretty volatile. I mean, how do you feel about that? I know you haven't really dipped your toe into the Gibson pool.
Well, I've dipped my toe.
Yeah, dip your toe, your whole ankle, foot up to the knees, wading in.
My head has not yet gone onto the surface. So I think he might be right on, but here's the thing. Like, the parts of cyberspace that he was writing about aren't necessarily what's going to be visible to us now. Also,
true.
One of the things he didn't anticipate or doesn't show off in the story is everyone having this virtual life.
Oh, yeah. That is actually the one thing that I've noticed in some of his earlier works. There was still the sense of it was very exclusive. You know, it wasn't...
People who do this are specialists.
Exactly. And then you had these online groups that were even more exclusive. Mm-hmm. Whereas now, the internet is inclusive in its most radical form. I mean, if I took what I have now, my laptop, my smartphone, and I went into that novel and I showed them what I had, it would be mind-blowing. And it's like, I don't need to be a console cowboy. I just literally need to go to the Google icon on my phone, and I have everything I need. It's the ultimate inclusive resource. But in this one, in a way, because it was so exclusive, I guess I'll expand on this later, it really had limitless options because it was so much, it geared on so much of what that individual made of it.
Well, and, you know, a decent chunk of the book is him presenting what cyberspace would look and feel like. And I don't know that had existed before. In writing and storytelling.
No, not really.
Tron, a little bit. That was 82. Yeah. And also, Tron is so bare bones, right? I mean, all right, I'm mixing metaphors here, but, you know, Tron was so minimalist its conception.
I saw the remake. I did not see the original.
Well, the remake was largely a reboot with some mysticism
thrown in. Yeah, for good measure. So... And then, of course, there is no social media in Gibson's world. And social media, as we all know, has shaped the internet in ways that not even the characters in this book could even comprehend with all their gifts and all their talents. And how volatile, how violent they are, could imagine the violence of a comment thread. No one dies in a comment thread, but... Oh my goodness. You know, that's where the battles are. I mean, the body count in this novel, if you really think about it, is quite high, actually, at one point. But it's here we can say shots fired. There are no actual shots, but someone has said something, you know, where it's sort of like this bloodless battle between ideas and opinions. And that's our internet. That's our cyberspace now. You know, hopefully, knock on wood. I wouldn't say no one's died because of those ideas. We know that's not true. It's a kind of warfare that I don't even think Case could really wrap his head around in 1984.
Well, what we're dealing with today with misinformation and social media and people...
Fair point.
Like, I'm so old that I don't regard social media as being real.
Fair.
Even though...
Fair.
I realize, like, there is a real world impact, but... If some stranger goes, wow, you're really fucking stupid, man. Like, occasionally that appears in the comments thread of The Drunken Odyssey or on my YouTube videos. And it's like, all right, delete. Like, it's not an interesting criticism.
No, it doesn't. No, it has no value.
But
it has no value. It has no weight.
For people much younger than me, you know, which is why we really worry about children and social media, especially if for people who are shy and introverted, like being on social media, like that might seem realer than real life.
Yeah. And that can have some very, very mixed consequences. Very.
And also, I think our, you know, the internet today, it's very difficult to tell good stories using it because, one, it's so stupid.
Well, when you say stupid, I mean, I know what you mean, but what do you mean in this particular context?
Like, well, why don't you just prove the earth isn't flat? Because the world is flat. And you really can't prove it. And every political variety of that statement, people just assuming that they can assert their own reality.
It's true. Flat earthers are so depressing.
In order to... Well, I'm using flat earthers, so we don't have to go through QAnon and all that, but...
Oh, still, no. They're like one of the most depressing groups out there. Like, the more I think about it, like, you know, the more I weep. I weep for humanity.
If you prove the world is flat, what do you win?
Nothing. I don't know. You know what? They can... If the earth is flat, they are welcome to go all around the world to prove the earth is flat. And I feel that in Gibson's world, you feel like those arguments, no one was having these arguments online. Like, you feel like what was happening was terrifying, but at least, you know, it did have weight and it mattered and it was important. And even though it was horrific and bloody and convoluted and, of course, contributed to the massive social and economic inequality of this world, at the same time, you know, they dealt in absolutes. There was no, this is valid because I feel it's valid. No, it's like, this is how it is. This is what is happening. We're not going to hide it. And if you want to believe that in, this world that's going around on the internet, Delulu, which is delusional. You know, if you want to wait in the realm of Delulu, go ahead. But me and the neon chrysanthemum, sorry, it's one word I have a hard time saying. We are going to hack into this mainframe for the glory of whatever. And that is something I don't want to say I found comforting. It wasn't comforting in William Gibson's world, but I felt went with the pure logic and the coldness, that absolute rock solid ideals behind everything with no softness, no middle ground. And when I first picked it up in middle school, so much of it went over my head. And then the more I read it...
I imagine it would have to, yeah.
Yeah, I was one of those kids, like very precocious.
But still. This is advanced.
That went over my head. And I was like, okay. And then when I revisited again and again and again, and even into my adulthood and the middling years, as we call them, I really appreciate it for what it is. And I feel that it's this... strange anchor in the very rocky world of internet and cyberspace, which can leave one feeling completely unmoored. And I have to say, in the right hands, I feel this would be a really great miniseries or movie, and I wouldn't mind seeing it adapted. There's so many things I'm very protective of, but this is like, I'd like to see that. I wouldn't mind. And the right hands, whatever those hands might be.
Yeah. I'm not gunning for this to be adapted. Or if it's adapted, it has to be adapted in such a strange way. Like when David Cronenberg made a film of Naked Lunch, there was very little naked lunch in that movie, actually.
Because Cronenberg did Naked Lunch? You know what? That makes a lot of sense.
So there are a couple of anecdotes from Naked Lunch, and the idea of Inner Zone is extracted. But I don't know if you know the story of Naked Lunch, but it's
been a long time since I've sat down with it, a very long time. I think it was college.
So
when I lived at that.
Burroughs was writing all this stuff, and he had like these chunks or chapters, but he wasn't writing a linear narrative. And so I think it was Allen Ginsberg helps him fit this into a manuscript. And they just, okay, now that it's in a pile, and he goes, all right, let's think about the ideal order. And Burroughs goes, no, I think the order is ideal, but let's switch the first and last chapters so that the book kind of makes more sense the longer you read. But that's because shit gets introduced like halfway through the book that you've already been reading about. And as a reading experience, that really can't be duplicated. And I think there would be a violence done to the book.
Mm.
And also, I think we would be comparing it to The Matrix. But
of course,
like when he goes into the cyberspace and he's describing it, it's such a bizarre, funky, mental, tingling sensation you get. And I think film would either be too easy or too derivative.
I feel like
I could be proven wrong.
I certainly don't
wish to deny William Gibson money if he gets the chance to have this adapted in a way that he would think is worth a shot.
I feel that if we were able to do this in this world, it would feel like a full body Charlie horse. Have you ever had a Charlie horse? That muscle cramp, it's incredibly painful. I've had them. They're actually quite terrifying. And I feel like it would be a full body Charlie horse to me. So I feel that it's amazing, but I don't feel that it's pleasant. Like, there's very little in the book that says it's a pleasant experience. It's exhilarating. It makes you feel powerful. You're almost godlike, but I don't think it's particularly nice. Well,
part of the subtext is Henry Case is such a good cowboy because he's a drug addict, because he has an addictive personality.
Hmm.
And the excitement of experiencing cyberspace, including hitchhiking inside the mind of someone else. So there are times when he is embedded in Molly's mind. Molly, who's our kind of fixer, assassin.
She is all around. She's brilliant.
Right. So she's got augmented sight and she's got a...
Her fingernails. You can't... Minor spoiler. Her fingernails are incredible. They look manicured, but they retract to...
Expose these blades.
Imagine like 10 scalpels coming out of your hands, which as a woman, I would love to have just to keep us safe in daily life.
She's a badass and she's so important to this book as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, maybe Gibson's a feminist because she's actually a tougher character than Case.
She is. She is.
Maybe smarter.
Oh,
she
definitely.
Certainly can anticipate problems quicker than he can. I don't know that she, you know, has his facility with being a hacker.
But she's smart. But as a street guy,
she can handle herself on the streets better than he can handle himself.
And I think in a way, and again, this could be my 21st century mind projecting onto a 1980s cyberpunk, you know, anti-hero protagonist, whatever he is. But in a way, Case has had the privilege of bringing so much chaos into his life. And he welcomes it. He brings it in where I feel that so much has happened to Molly. She has had to, for the sake of her own preservation, not only rise above it, but change her body so she cannot be hurt or taken advantage of again, kind of. No big shock.
Not without a fight.
No big shock. Her backstory is not very pleasant. And she does this, and she not only has street smarts, but she's smart. And she moves in the world without this incredible baggage of being a druggie and being, you know, disappointed and woe is me. And I can do nothing without being a console cowboy. She just sees everything with such clarity and sometimes such brutality. But
well, she's got bionic eyes.
She has bionic eyes. Literally, she can see clearer. Yes. As someone who is incredibly reliant on glasses, yes. She literally sees everything clearly. And I feel that she has to be the grounding force and the foundation for this hero who is just a kite in the wind.
Case would he wouldn't declare, I live for chaos, it's my jam.
Mm.
But if things are going well for too long, he finds a way to fuck things up.
He's what is it, anhedonia, the fear of happiness. And so if everything is really stable and good and he's in the black, you know, bank balance wise, he's like, well, naturally it's time for me to set everything on fire. And yeah, he does that. And the thing is, you don't even know why he stole from his employer, which, of course, as I said before, you know, sets the events of the film off. Or not the film, sorry, the novel.
Well, if you're stealing for an employer,
Well, they're stealing for and they're stealing from.
Right. But there's that line in Casino where it's like, if you hire someone to steal, you have to expect he's going to take some for himself. And the gangsters in that movie didn't buy it either.
Oh, no. Then again, I think the world that he lives in has also been so brutalized by advancement. I think there's a scene later in the book where he sees a horse, and it's very rare for people in this world to see animals. This is not a world that it has experienced. It doesn't go into it, but there's ecological collapse. I mean, imagine, say, you're in your 20s, like Case, and you've never seen a horse. You've never seen a dog, a bird. You've never seen a rhinoceros at the zoo. This is a world that has completely broken down and is trying to rebuild itself in the most inorganic way. And then I think if you grow up in that world, I think his parents are dead. He's an orphan. Something's probably happened with that as well. It's only natural that you invite chaos in. There's sort of that comfort of what was it? Kind of always having your hand on your finger on the buzzer. How did they describe that in the beginning with Chiba City? There's a really great line about the whole city that he lives in, but he basically describes it as an experience, an experiment in evolution. What was it? You can't break the surface tension. Yeah, something to that effect.
So one of the things that I thought was brilliant is just his imagining what it's like to be inside the mind of another person. So that being in Molly's mind, jacking into Molly's mind when she's injured, means he feels the pain like it's his pain.
Yeah, she breaks her leg, doesn't she? She, among other things.
That happens along the way.
Yeah. You know, that was one thing that it was thought that we would be able to not only go into cyberspace, but we were able to go into people's minds that, oh my goodness, AI is huge in this world. In fact, I don't want to spoil too much, because I would like anyone who has not read this novel to sit down with it afterward. But AI in this case is incredibly advanced. I think it makes what we have look like, I don't want to say look like a game of Pong, but it's pretty much its own person at that point, would you say?
Well, I think that's the theme of the book is there's an AI out there eager to break what's called Turing locks.
Yeah, I love the name Turing locks. That was perfect.
An allusion to the Turing test, which is a way of
Alan Turing
trying to test not robotic, but artificial intelligence, right? A robot is the machinery of a humanoid walking around, which may or may not have any relationship to like a computing brain in that apparatus. Where AI is meant to simulate thought, simulate creation. And, you know, Alan Turing had this sense of, okay, well, if you ask a series of questions, you can figure out, you know, and this is actually standard for storytelling about AI, right? It comes up over and over again in Blade Runner where...
Oh, yeah, the void comp test.
Yeah.
Which is essentially kind of a weird Turing test.
Yeah, and the detective in that story, you know, does this test on a woman who works for...
Rachel. Yes.
And the interview process goes on for a long time. And basically, Deckard guesses. But the scientist who is behind all of this, the tech guy, said, what do you think? And he goes, oh, yeah, she's a robot, right? But it wasn't like, oh, on question 8, I got it figured out. It's more like we've asked like 300 questions and I lean a certain way, but I don't feel definitively. And yeah, I think that's a really interesting question.
Yeah.
And that, which is why Star Trek The Next Generation, I hated that show so much.
Really?
Because
I loved it.
Like, oh, Data's almost human. And I'm like, oh, he passed human. Like, decades before this show started. Like, it's not close. And I realize watching an artificial intelligence work up towards having the freedom of thought that a human mind might have it'd be a little bit like, I don't know, talking to a dumb child over and over again in a story, right? It's not the most entertaining thing to watch.
No. And the thing is, the AI in this novel is absolutely incredible, and it's so advanced, and it's so nuanced. And then I think about, at least to me, I feel
the AIs in conversation in this story are very semantically exact. And so they refuse basic human terminology for a lot of things that come under discussion, including identity. So I thought, yeah, that was kind of fascinating, is the AI invents terms for things and phrases its reality in a way that is more accurate than this really basic human approach to things, like human, non-human. And it's like, to an AI, that's not necessarily an interesting distinction.
Well, then I think about the way we're currently treating AI now and panic. I mean, when I think about how the general public perceives AI right now, it's pure panic, whether it's going to steal our jobs, rob us our creative livelihoods, or, you know, sort of strip us of our inherent purpose as human beings on this planet. And while, of course, AI is quite advanced on levels that probably we in the public aren't even aware of, it's in its absolute infancy, especially when I read not just William Gibson, but when I read other writers. Yes, you can have a conversation with it at this point, but even then, it's just sort of spoon-fed these very, like, typical, you know, it's the algorithm. It's like you ask it a question, this is how it's going to answer it. It's like a toddler. And then, of course, we have, I follow a Facebook page, Midjourney, where you plug in prompts and you're given a work of art. Oh, this is going to strip artists of their purpose, and yet art is being created every day independent of AI. And if anything, AI art has already been declared completely derivative. So here we have something that is like...
For now,
for everyone screaming on the end. For now, we have the equivalent of a three-year-old toddler kind of screaming and shouting and tumbling into the void. Whereas in Neuromancer, you have a full-grown adult with all of the experience and nuance, and is really, I'm going to call it a character, is one of the most, it's not quite sympathetic, but you understand where they're coming from. And this vast well of feeling that it has that seems almost beyond AI. And here we are, you know, this is not Skynet that we're dealing with. Knock on wood, fingers crossed. And we're ready to completely dismantle it before it even knows what it is. I mean, there are going to be people that don't agree with me. There'll be old screes about what AI is. But when I think about the vast potential that William Gibson in a lot of his writing is able to put into AI, again, to me, that feels so much more authentic than what we have going right now, which is, of course, you know, it's spouting think pieces and very good think pieces and very good essays and genuine thoughtfulness, but again, with something that is in its infancy that you have to wonder if it even knows what it is. Whereas in Neuromancer, slight spoiler, it very much knows what it is. And there endeth the lecture.
It also knows it's evolving.
Exactly. It knows it's not even a complete person.
So that...
it can be better. Be best.
Well, as a literary podcaster, you are probably not surprised to learn that I've been bombarded by PR requests to have the Drunken Odyssey, a podcast about the writing life, cover AI and all of its various glorious...
I can only
applications
imagine.
For business, because that's what we do here. And the tone is messianic. Isn't it great? All the things AI can do. And one, I'm like, yeah, it's such a bizarre thing for me to get. So that I actually wrote back asking if the PR person was itself an AI, because none of this makes any sense.
Was it?
There's no way for me to confirm that would be the case.
Yeah. Henry Case reaching out through the void.
As a conspiracy story, it keeps getting deeper and deeper.
I mean, I think about the sheer volume of literature that's created by people right now. you know, even by myself, poetry, short stories, things that sit in my computer. In fact, right in front of me, I have a flash drive, which in a sheer panic, I could not find. I know you people can't see it, but it's less than the length of my thumb. And it holds a lot of what I write, what I create. And let me just put you back in the box there. And it's...
Yeah, you don't want it eavesdropping on this conversation.
Exactly. I'll just have it sit in my eyeglass case where it can't hear anything. But there are people that are still writing. There are things that are still happening. And AI is, again, already being dismissed to the point where professors will not even take a paper if they think they have a shadow of a doubt of a shade that you have used that to create your thesis or the core of your argument. You know, we're already willing to push it aside because it is not authentic. And there is so much authentic work being created. I feel that it might actually be pushing us to be more assertive as human writers. I don't think I'm alone in that. I don't know how you feel, especially if you're getting a lot of requests about that.
Well, to cover, you know, business, which is apparently my beat.
Apparently, if you've never listened to The Drunken Odyssey.
Yeah, but the tone from the business world is, isn't this great? How exciting this new thing is. And just taking that for granted. And it's like, I don't. And also, people are awful. So that when we tell AI, oh, make me art in this style. Apparently, like one of the trends is asking AI to create art in which SpongeBob is responsible for 9/11.
Yeah. See, when I hear that.
That's not the AI going, oh, here's a good idea. It's no weird people going, make me this art.
Yeah. It does kind of make me wonder if AI ever reached the level that it does in Neuromancer, what it would make of that. Well, that's when I mentioned Midjourney. That's what it does. It's people feeding in algorithms to this program that says, yes, you know, paint me the cast of SpongeBob in the style of Baroque paintings. And then it produces what I think we can all imagine is a very florid style with, you know, SpongeBob holding grapes or something. But yeah, it's still very much a toy for some people. Give me this, make me that, show me this. And at the same time, it's seen as like, oh my gosh, this is going to like, this will be the end of humanity. And, you know, we're barely at the starting line.
I'm very wary of AI.
Oh, no, I know you are. I know.
And here's why. We live in a time with such great proliferation of media. And there are people who, I just think of Republicans in Congress, chief job.
I don't want to, but okay.
Whose chief job is to create content, not to govern, not to lead, just to own the libs, but make sure you're on camera when you do it. And, you know, on YouTube, there are channels I love. And then I go, you know, like, okay, does anyone have any new videos for me to watch? And then I'm just kind of appalled at just how much content is being manufactured. And remember when in a given year, there might be 50 movies that come out and now it's hundreds and hundreds and like, just what do I feel like trying to watch? And if someone says, oh, I really love this TV show, there are 4 seasons, you really should check it out. I'm like, it's a lot of fucking work.
It is.
Even if I like it, I almost want to not like it because I want my time back. And like, there's too much stuff. There's too much stuff. And the idea that as soon as AI can get over that uncanny valley in terms of writing stories, the Hollywood executives will fire every writer in a heartbeat.
Oh, yeah.
If you think about their attitude towards their product and towards audiences. Very few movies are made to be enjoyed 10 years from now and 20 years from now.
That's actually a really good point. That is a good point.
You know, movies are made to earn some money today, tomorrow, and by next year, who cares? we got more content to generate.
They're made to be forgettable. That is true. I mean, whenever I hear people saying, oh, there's no more good movies, there's no more good music, there's no more good TV shows, I kind of despair at that, because there really is so much good content being created. What frustrates me is that the good content is being buried among so much mediocre content. Like, there's several things that I watch right now that I really enjoy. And you kind of have to find the good stuff among the mediocre. I mean, of course, to me, I do love The Great British Bake Off. I will always watch that. That's very public. Everyone knows about that. But then we also have the miniseries from Japan, or the film from Spain, or the French comedy. You know, that sort of thing that you actually have to find and think like, oh, hey, there are people really creating stuff out there that's interesting and worthwhile and thoughtful.
And I could be content if no new movies ever got made. And okay, we've got over a century of movies.
Let's see what we have.
Yeah, so I could totally see myself being a recluse living in a cabin and just watching nothing but old media and reading old books.
It's true. It's true. And I think that's really tempting. I do hear that. Like, oh, I want to live in a cabin in the woods and I want to disconnect from social media and the internet.
He says while recording another podcast to be released into the world.
Yeah, no, it's like while we use the internet and multimedia. But I think that's the one thing with the whole like sci-fi genre as a whole, and especially with William Gibson, was that, you know, this embracing of the future for good or for ill. And the future was very much what we made of it. And it's clear that in Gibson's world, we have both made something of it and we've messed up on so many levels. But at the same time, it very much serves us what we do. And one thing that I wanted to touch on, which you may remember, is how polarized this world is. There doesn't really seem to be a middle class. Everything's, you know, it's very rarefied. You know, you have people like in orbiting space stations on holiday, and then you have people who Las Vegas in space, and then you have people
that's like, called Freeside, by the way.
Yeah, Freeside. Just, you know, in a nice dose of irony. And you have, you know,
come live in the off-world colonies.
Yeah. Was it a fabulous off-world colonies today? And then you have people who live below, who function the best they can, and who find stability and riches and freedom in the underworld. And you could say, well, isn't that happening right now? And I'm like, yes, it is. Yes, it is. I mean, I'm not saying I'm going to dive into the dodgy world of trading like Julius Dean, who's a really strange character, by the way. But you can see that we thought this... That, you know, that's another thing. You know, he doesn't shy away from the fact that a more technologically advanced world does not automatically make us more egalitarian, because this world is not egalitarian. And I don't even want to say it's quite dog-eat-dog. I mean, it is and it isn't, but you have corporations that wield power and influence and have private armies. You have people, citizens who, you know, use their talent to live these extraordinary lives.
Well, if there's a middle class, it's not on view.
No, and goodness knows what they're up to. But I have to say, there is part of me that, you know, if you could crawl inside the pages of a book and live there for a week, I have to say I wouldn't mind going into a Gibson novel. I mean, it'd be quite an interesting week. But just to sort of see that view of the future from the past, especially the 80s, you know, where you had a very distinct idea of what the world was going to be like. So.
Well, and he guessed right about so many things.
He did. I think so. Oh, I found that passage, by the way. Page 7.
You have to tell them what edition that is, otherwise a citation is meaningless.
It's the Ace Science Fiction paperback, and this was published. Sorry about the page noises. I guess it's ASMR for someone. Okay.
I think the sound of turning pages is acceptable on the Drunken Odyssey.
Exactly. Okay. Ace Edition, July 1986. Yeah. So by 86, I was walking. And I love this description of the Night City, because I feel that in a very slow way, this is becoming what we have now, our world. Night City was like a deranged experiment in social Darwinism designed by a bored researcher who kept one thumb permanently on the fast forward button. Stop hustling and you sank without a trace, but move a little too swiftly and you break the fragile service tension of the black market. Either way, you were gone and nothing left of you but some vague memory in the mind of a fixture like rats. The heart or lungs or kidneys might survive in the service of some stranger with new yen for the clinic tanks. So, yeah, that was the world. And, you know, you think about, and especially on social media, the word I hear again and again and again to, like, I think I'm going to throw something, is hustle. You know what the word hustle means, right? You know what it means, John. I mean, the word hustle. Like, what is a hustle to you?
Finding customers for a prostitute?
No, but, I mean, yes.
This is what happens when you ask me a question.
When I think of a hustle, I think of a scam. I think of something that's very dubious. I think of very fast motion, purely in the service of the person in motion, with no benefit or consideration to anyone around you in so much as it can service yourself. And the only long-term benefit is how it benefits you. And no matter how unethical or sketchy, as the youth say, or sus, as long as you come out on top and as long as you can go on Insta and get the likes and get the life and the money and whatever you consider worthwhile and clout, to me, that's the hustle. And you see it now. And for me, it's, I don't want to say what we have right now is social Darwinism on that scale of Night City, thank goodness, but there is a sort of social Darwinism. And of course, in his later writings, William Gibson, he saw that before we did, or even before he saw it himself. He identified, that's where we're going. And I can't quite put my finger on it, but that's where we're heading. What do you think on that?
Well, I think he's fairly adept at that. But, you know, what impresses me more is all the other things he makes happen in a story. Mm. Because if he guesses wrong, and that was the whole point of the reading experience, or the biggest point, then you're like, well, that was a fucking waste of my time. But the way he writes, even if he gets something wrong, like, yeah, in the imaginary future, if he's writing about a future that turns out to look a lot different than the future we're hatching right now, there's so many pleasures to the reading that it doesn't matter. Whereas if you were a less ambitious writer, if you just wanted to write, I don't mean to sound mean, but boilerplate science fiction, you know, without a sense of style, without a sense of menace, without the literary flourishes that he brings to his characterizations and it's his ability
without
to
the multifaceted aspect
present
of his
the
work.
World in such an immediate way that's already, you know, like, happening. Because of his ability to do all that, it makes his scientific thought process less important to the overall whole. And it doesn't hurt that he gets so much right and kind of encourages us to think about these problems in ways that, for example, corporate America apparently isn't thinking about these problems.
Well, no, I don't think corporate America really thinks too much about the future of everyone else, just of itself. I don't think that's a particular concern of theirs. That was another thing about the way the corporate world would use the internet and technology. Because, see, in our world and in what we have them utilizing social media, Twitter before Elon Musk. They were utilizing social media, Instagram, TikTok. They were utilizing personalities, and it all seemed very glitzy and very shiny and very polished. And in Gibson's world, you have private armies, you have corporate espionage. And I'm not saying that's not happening right now, but in this novel, it is very much the accepted and common use of the internet and of cyberspace and of information. You know, it was a it was another weapon in the great arsenal of success, of being top dog, of being number one. And it's wholly acceptable. Like, you don't have people necessarily going after them. Like, this is the thing, you know. It's like, do police even exist here? I mean, yes, of course they do in this particular world. But, you know,
we even see police at one point.
Oh, we do, vaguely. But yeah, this is
kind of an Interpol thing.
Well, yeah.
Unofficially.
Unofficially, but that goes really...
International police just don't respect international law. You get the police in this book.
No, and I think it goes like terribly, horribly pear-shaped. To put it mildly. So yeah, that was the thing, is that, you know, I could almost say, well, thank goodness they're not using social media and the internet in the real world the way they use it in Neuromancer. I mean, no one wants to have a small, private group of foot soldiers storm their office building, you know, 2 hours before clock out time. No one wants that.
Yeah. So what was it like the first time you read it? And a lot of it was over your head. You stuck with it.
That's a really good question. For me, when I first sat down as a middle school kid with my sci-fi novel in the library, I could imagine that something really big was happening. And this person was describing the world that I thought we were going to have. And as so much of it went over my head, I clung to the bare bones aspect of the story and its heroes and its heroines. And I saw them really almost quite two-dimensional. You know, I saw Case as the true hero, this faultless figure. And I saw Molly Millions as, you know, the true heroine, as this almost romantic subplot, which, of course, I wouldn't call it romantic what they do. They just sort of do what they do.
It's romantic, but not...
Yeah, it is, yeah.
In a world in which commitment is iffy.
Fluid, yeah. It's a very fluid world when it comes to your personal life. And commitment is a bit shaky. And then when I got older and I read it again and again, it's almost like it went from being in black and white to full color. And you realize, you know, what's really happening. And then you look at what's happening in the world and you think, oh, this is where it's coming from. This is what we're seeing. So it was like an onion. The story, the layers, like as time went on, the layers just peeled off and I saw deeper and deeper for what it was. And I started reading more William Gibson. And, you know, again, starting in middle school, you know, so I read, you know, Idoru and all that. And as the layers came off, and I saw this world that I didn't know that I wanted, but was exciting. And I looked around, you know, in the 90s to see, you know, what was going on. And I thought, is this possible? Is this perhaps now? And for me, it was strangely, wildly, profoundly appealing. And even when it, you know, went to full color and all the unpleasantness and all the nastiness, I thought, but yes, the potential that lies in this world is amazing. It's, you know, it's kind of surprising. I never went into STEM and I went to the humanities instead, which I can't imagine what kind of foothold the humanities has in the world of William Gibson in this particular situation. But yeah, it was a novel that was just constantly revealing itself to me in every way, shape, and form. I mean, it may be a few years before I pick it up again, and perhaps it'll have something new to say, or bizarrely, it might feel nostalgic, like, oh, that's so cute. That's what they thought would happen. I am a bit disappointed we don't have space stations for leisure and paragliding and gourmet meals. I'm very disappointed that we don't have that.
Well, if we had that, we couldn't have that.
Fair point.
Because that's for rich people.
That is for rich people. That is. Yeah. He does not shy away from the fact that incredible tech will, of course, be always used for the fun, the pleasure, and the excitement of the upper classes. And that everyone else who wants to be part of that has to be a commodity. Oh my gosh, that's another thing. People are commodities. They are literally tools. They're walking, talking, human flash drives. You know, it's like you have to almost strip yourself of humanity in order to really live. And he does that without sentiment. I mean, again, I don't know how much of the Sprawl trilogy you've read, but there's a very unsentimental view about...
Well, I read Neuromancer that one time.
That whole aspect that, yeah, we willingly turn ourselves into a commodity to give ourselves the life and the future that we think we deserve, to the point where we don't really think much of it and do everything we can to be the shiniest, the newest toy on the block. You know, even if we don't have razor blades coming out of our fingers, we become the most efficient. We become the most appealing, the attractive. Someone who can move seamlessly between worlds. So yeah, and you could say that's happening now. Maybe not on this level, but it is happening. We become a commodity.
Well, that is the show for this week. I would like to thank Rachel Tillman and Isaiah Portillo for editing this episode. Don't forget to check out thedrunkenodyssey.com throughout the week for all kinds of great written content, including Perfect Advice from Dr. Perfect, Heartbreaking Comic Book Reviews by Drew Barth, and of course, reviews of classic cinema by Jeff Schuster, who is our very own curator of schlock. Until next week, put your ass in the chair, keep attacking those keys, and don't swallow the worm.
Dear listeners, writers, and fellow Odysseans, send your questions, observations, complaints, manifestos, transcriptions of Turkish opera, and whatever else you got to thedrunkenodyssey@gmail.com.
Sailor Jerry, only you understand me.
Thank you for listening to The Drunken Odyssey with John King, a podcast about the writing life. This is your announcer, Lauren Butler.